From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I can't put it any better than Jackie Kennedy did after the Cuban Missile Crisis. She said that what worried President Kennedy during that very dangerous time was that a war might be started, not by big men with self-control and restraint, but by little men, the ones moved by fear and pride.
That was Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton during her acceptance speech at the DNC last Thursday.
America's strength doesn't come from lashing out. It relies on smarts, judgment, cool resolve, and the precise and strategic application of power. And that's the kind of commander-in-chief I pledge to be.
Let's review the record.
That was Republican nominee Donald Trump at his acceptance speech a week earlier with the RNC.
In 2009, pre-Hillary, ISIS was not even on the map. Libya was stable. Egypt was peaceful. Iraq was seeing and really a big, big reduction in violence. Iran was being choked by sanctions. Syria was somewhat under control. After 4 years of Hillary Clinton, what do we have? ISIS has spread across the region and the entire world. Libya is in ruins, and our ambassador and his staff were left helpless to die at the hands of savage killers. Egypt was turned over to the radical Muslim Brotherhood, forcing the military to retake control. Iraq is in chaos. Iran is on the path to nuclear weapons. Syria is engulfed in a civil war, and a refugee crisis now threatens the West. After 15 years of wars in the Middle East, after trillions of dollars spent and thousands of lives lost, the situation is worse than it has ever been before. This is the legacy of Hillary Clinton. Death, destruction, terrorism, and weakness.
A week later, the former Secretary of State, as she accepted the nomination in Philadelphia, laid out her plan for defeating ISIS.
I've laid out my strategy for defeating ISIS. We will strike their sanctuaries from the air and support local forces taking them out on the ground. We will surge our intelligence so we detect and prevent attacks before they happen. We will disrupt their efforts online to reach and radicalize young people in our country. It won't be easy or quick, but make no mistake, we will prevail.
Clinton was laying out what has essentially been the strategy of the Obama administration in combating terrorism. The Republican nominee proposed a week earlier a different tack.
We must abandon the failed policy of nation building and regime change that Hillary Clinton pushed in Iraq, in Libya, in Egypt, and in Syria.
Responsibility for the destruction of Libya was also laid at the feet of the former Secretary of State by Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries. And less than a week after Clinton's speech came revelations of a new U.S. bombing campaign in Libya, as well as the presence of U.S. special forces there on the ground. Zafar Bangash is the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. He spoke with Brian Becker, who hosts Radio Sputnik's daily news magazine, Loud and Clear, about the announcement of the renewed U.S. bombing of Libya.
I think it was anticipated because the government, or one of the governments, there are so many of them in Libya, but the one that is based in Tripoli, which is called the Government of National Accord, it was established through an agreement on December the 17th of last year. and it's headed by a person by the name of al-Sarraj, Fayez al-Sarraj. There is a presidential council of seven members and recognized by the UN as well as by a number of Western countries. But this government is based in Tripoli, that means in the west of the country, and it doesn't have control over the rest of the country, which means it doesn't have control in the east, where there is another government, or at least a strong man, General Khalifa Haftar, who has strong support in the Libyan National Army. And then the south, of course, is completely wide open. So this government of national accord really did not have much control in the country as such. But it went after Sirte. It's the hometown of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. He was born there, and his tribe, the Gaddafi tribe, is one of the major tribes over there. There, these terrorist groups, ISIS or ISIL, etc., have been entrenched since 2015. Now, the government of al-Sarraj launched a campaign against ISIL or ISIS terrorists back in May. They haven't made much progress. And I think what the U.S. feared was that if this government that they have recognized that they are not able to take control or not able to defeat the ISIL terrorists, then this is going to create another problem in the region. I'm not quite sure exactly whether they are going to solve the problem, because one of the difficulties with these terrorist groups is that you attack them, and that provides, particularly if foreign forces attack them, they then use that as a source of legitimacy for their own actions. So while the U.S. has launched these campaigns, aerial attacks, they haven't said how long these are going to last. In fact, they appear to be open-ended. And if they are, then I'm sure that we can anticipate car bombings and other kinds of attacks occurring in different parts of Libya, and in particular in Tripoli, or where the ministers of the Government of National Accord are. So although one could say that we could anticipate the U.S. doing that, I think the end result is going to be very, very uncertain.
Right, because you can't really defeat your enemy or most enemies simply by an air war. You can do a lot of damage. You can blow things up. You can kill a lot of people. But you don't dislodge those forces from the ground that they hold. That requires a ground force. Is there a ground force available to oust ISIS from that area?
As far as foreign troops are concerned, there are no ground forces, except, of course, for a limited number of French special forces, although a number of Western governments are involved in Libya at the present time. These include the U.S., Britain, France, and Italy. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, three members of the French Special Forces were killed when their helicopter crashed. And ironically, the West, while on the one hand is claiming that it's supporting this government of national accord, at the same time, they're also providing aerial support to General Khalifa Haftar, who's based in Benghazi and who leads a rival government over there. And of course, the tribes in the east are not in favor of the government in Tripoli. I also want to point out that in his testimony before the U.S. Senate, General Thomas Waldhauser, who is the chairman of Africa Central Command, had in fact said that the present policy of the U.S. government of using only air power is not sufficient and that ground forces would be needed. So it seems to me that the U.S. is actually preparing the ground for introducing its own ground forces. These probably are likely to be special forces backed by drones, etc. But that is the direction that I see developing if the U.S. continues with its attack on these terrorist groups. Now, although I have absolutely no sympathy with these terrorist groups. The concern that I have is that the policy that has been adopted to confront them is not likely to yield any results, as it hasn't in any of the other places where the U.S. and its so-called allies have been involved. And what is more likely is the way the scenario is evolving or developing is that these people, ISIS, ISIL group, etc., they will just simply go underground. They will also attract more people from other places, and then they will penetrate into Tripoli itself and start carrying out bombing campaigns, starting blowing up places, buildings, and even trying to carry out assassination attempts. For instance, they did against the interior minister in the government of National Accord, although the interior minister escaped. But I think these kinds of attacks are likely to escalate. One other factor, which I think is quite problematic, is that nobody really knows how many people or how many members of ISIS or ISIL there are in Sirte. Some estimates say only 100, others say 1,000. And we have even read reports of at least 10,000 of them. Now, you know, this is a guessing game. You don't go around, military operations are not carried out on guessing games. And I think this is where the problems lie.
We are talking with Zafar Bangash. He's talking to us from Toronto. He is on the editorial board of Crescent International, and he is the founder of the Institute for Contemporary Islamic Thought. We're talking about Libya. Zafar Bangash, let me just keep going with the same discussion. The U.S. says they're going to begin and have begun the bombing in Sirte to defeat or to dislodge or to degrade ISIL. If the bombing doesn't succeed in defeating them, which both you and I are saying, and in fact, the general who spoke before the U.S. Congress also agreed that bombing by itself won't defeat them. There is then the logic of escalation, because if the United States commits itself to the destruction or the bombing of ISIS and it doesn't succeed, then the logic is, okay, we must do something more. Now, in less than 6 months, President Obama will no longer be president. There will be a new president. Most likely, it will be Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was the chief cheerleader, the main voice, the main advocate for the bombing of Libya in 2011. And in October 2011, when Gaddafi was lynched, essentially on the street, brutally murdered, he was the head of state, she laughingly said, "We came, we saw, he died." That was captured on video. I mean, odd, very unusual, I would say, in American or world politics for some sort of esteemed diplomat to be talking like that. But it was her policy. So if Obama now has an open-ended bombing, and the open-ended bombing won't suppress ISIS, and Hillary Clinton will be the next president, it does seem to be the prescription, in fact, and perhaps a thought-through prescription for a continued advancing escalation where the United States could be in Libya for a very, very long time.
I think you are absolutely right. You put your finger on the crux of the matter. Hillary Clinton is the architect of the U.S.-Libya disaster. It, in fact, also led to the murder of the U.S. ambassador on September the 11th of 2012 in Benghazi, in the U.S. consulate over there. And a number of other people died. And these were the people, the murderers, the terrorists, were in fact the ones that the U.S. government had backed in trying to overthrow the government of Colonel Gaddafi and leading to his lynching in October of 2011. In fact, Gaddafi had said prior to his overthrow that if he were overthrown, Libya would descend into chaos and nobody would be able to control it. Whether we like Gaddafi or not, I mean, he's dead now, but whether we liked his policies or not, the fact of the matter is that he kept Libya together, that he kept these groups in check, and that, in fact, he pursued a policy whereby he tried to provide benefits to his people. I can tell you, I've spoken to a number of Libyans, and though they were never supporters of Colonel Gaddafi, they now regret that he has been overthrown because Libya has now descended into absolute chaos. There are warlords all over the place. There are, in fact, about 50 different groups or warlords that are operating in Libya, and they are not under anybody control. Recent reports have suggested that, in fact, Colonel Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, who was incidentally sentenced to death last August, in August of 2015, he was released from prison in April of this year. And now a number of tribes are actually regrouping around him, sick and tired of the mayhem, the kidnappings, the killings, the bombings, etc. And particularly groups in the south are rallying around him, and they want to see him bring some kind of order to society. So I get the feeling that perhaps the U.S. campaign in CERT is actually also an attempt to preempt Saif al-Islam Gaddafi from regrouping the various tribes in Libya and coming to power, because that would then undermine the U.S. and Western plan for Libya, and that is to install a puppet government in the country.
Zafar Bangash, one theory that's been held by numerous people who are in the anti-war movement, both in the United States and around the world, people who have been out in the streets protesting against the Iraq war, protesting against the Libya war, protesting against the U.S. determination to oust the Assad government, is that part of the plan with the United States, with all of these interventions, is not simply to create a passive regime, a client state, so to speak, but actually to fragment, to weaken these countries, that it plays to the strength of or benefits Israel, benefits the United States. I personally believe that the fragmentation of these countries is more or less the unintended consequences of an imperial strategy that has been a catastrophe, of course, for the people in those countries, but also catastrophic in terms of the U.S.'s own plans. In other words, just based on small, feckless thinking. How do you see that?
Well, you see, this whole policy that the U.S. is pursuing was the one that was thrust upon successive U.S. administrations by the neocons. These Zionists who essentially wanted what they called was controlled chaos in these countries. And no less a person than General Wesley Clark actually confirmed in an interview with Democracy Now! On March the 7th of 2007, that a week after the attacks of 9/11, he had gone to the Pentagon, and one of the generals that used to work for him called him into his office and said, "Sir, I'd like you to see this." And General Wesley Clark said that he was shown a piece of paper that had been sent to him from Rumsfeld's office, who was upstairs in the Pentagon, in which seven countries were listed that the U.S. was going to attack, including, of course, starting with Iraq and then, you know, Libya and Lebanon and Syria, Yemen, etc., Sudan. All of these countries were included in that, and their ultimate destination, of course, was to destroy Iran. Now, we know, if you look at the list of countries that General Wesley Clark identified, several of them have already been so Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Libya, Somalia is in shambles, Sudan. And now you see that, you know, the chaos that's all around the place. So I think it seems to me that this was a policy, the U.S. policy all along, that they wanted to essentially totally destabilize these countries. And this was meant to give a free hand to the Zionist state of Israel. And even though the U.S. has not succeeded in Iraq, it has not succeeded in Syria, it has succeeded to some extent in Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen, although Yemen also, they're not very successful because the Saudis are so damn incompetent, they can't do anything, that this has created more problems for the U.S. than less. So their plan, of course, is not going according to script. Although I would say that the only thing that they have achieved is to create or sow destruction. So most of these countries have become non-operational. It would take decades and hundreds of billions of dollars to rebuild Syria. The same applies to Iraq, which is essentially now not one country, but three countries. Yemen, again, is badly fragmented and divided. Sudan has already been divided. So you see that fragmentation has already taken place. Even Syria, they're talking about fragmenting Syria into different enclaves given to warlords. But I don't think that is going to happen, because the Syrian people are much more sensible than any of the other people. But unfortunately, that chaos all around the region, we can see, and that is naturally not to the benefit of the people at all. The only country that benefits from this is the Zionist state of Israel.
That was Zafar Bangash, the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought and a member of the editorial board of Crescent Magazine, speaking with Brian Becker, the host of Radio Sputnik's daily news magazine, Loud and Clear. The possibility that the U.S. might be getting itself into a protracted war in Libya was raised at Tuesday's State Department press briefing by RT's Guyan Chichikayan.
It is clear that the UN-backed government of national accord in Libya cannot fight terrorists on its own. And that suggests the U.S. is going to be in Libya for a long time to come. And I asked the State Department, what is the U.S.'s overall strategy in Libya? Because you can only do so much with airstrikes. With chaos in the country, it seems to be only a matter of time before the next batch of terrorists pop up. And State Department's John Kirby said the U.S. strategy is to support the government of national accord, the GNA. With that comes another question. What happens to the part of Libya that does not support the GNA? In fact, Libya has a parallel government in Tobruk, whose parliament a few days ago refused to hold a vote of confidence in the GNA. Is the U.S. concerned about these internal dynamics as it throws its weight behind the GNA here?
At a time when the GNA is having a difficult time unifying the country, do you think UN backing and now U.S. military support could give a green light to give a sort of a signal to the GNA to crack down on parts of the country that won't go along with it?
Well, we're not interested in seeing a crackdown, to use your phrase. We're interested in seeing the GNA succeed. And to the other parties that you're talking about, we continue to call on them to support the GNA. The responsibility is on them to support the GNA, as the international community is supporting the GNA. That's the path forward here. That's the best thing for all Libyans. And so the degree that they want to obstruct, delay, obfuscate, and make more difficult the work of the GNA, then we're going to continue to call on them to cease those activities and support the GNA.
Is the U.S. arming or planning to arm forces under the control of the GNA?
I'm not aware of any such plans.
Even though UN Security Council members are backing the GNA, France reportedly supported General Khalifa Haftar's efforts to drive rebel fighters, including an al-Qaeda-affiliated group, from Libya's second biggest city, Benghazi. General Haftar has refused to support the UN-backed government of national accord because his forces were once loyal to a rival government. In July, the French government said three of its soldiers had been killed in a helicopter crash in eastern Libya, and the GNA blasted the French for their unauthorized military presence in the country. So as Western powers are going after extremists in Libya, it is not clear how they will affect internal dynamics there.
After the close of the RNC and the DNC, many are left asking themselves who exactly they can vote for if they're opposed to war, racism, Islamophobia, and anti-immigrant sentiment. Charles Barron is a former Black Panther and a former longtime member of the New York City Council who now sits as a member of the New York State Assembly. He shared his thoughts about the election with CPR's own Bernard White.
These are the worst two candidates, presidential candidates, in the history of American presidential politics. Hillary has a track record of actually bringing death and destruction internationally to an African nation like Libya, and having a regime change and being responsible for NATO and others killing Muammar Gaddafi. Hillary is also responsible for the negative legislation against Zimbabwean people and President Robert Mugabe. These are two powerful independent leaders that they've convinced the world that were the worst dictators the world has ever seen, and they're supporting terrorism and they're killing their own people like America cares about people dying, black people dying in Africa. They don't even care about black people dying in New Orleans right here. So that's internationally. And then there's the Iraq war, the Afghanistan, the drones being dropped in Pakistan. There's the Israel sponsoring state terrorism against the Palestinian people in the last attack on the Gaza Strip. 2,100 plus Palestinians killed, 500 of them babies, little babies. And they let Israel justify it by saying we have a right to defend ourselves from land that they're occupying and they're taking from the Palestinian people. And then when you come home domestically, it is Hillary Clinton who And during her time with Bill Clinton, they gave us 3 strikes you're in for life, and increased mass incarceration that ended welfare as we know it, 5-year program instead of a entitlement program for long as you can demonstrate need, creating more poverty. Poverty creates crime, and crime creates death and incarceration. It was Hillary Clinton that called us super predators, our children, our black youth. It was Hillary Clinton in the debate that pushed Obama into saying that Minister Farrakhan should be rejected. Obama had already said that he denounces his anti-Semitism, and then she said, that's not enough. You should reject him. And he said, I thought it's just a semantic thing. And then he finally said, okay, I reject him. And it's Hillary Clinton that did all of these things. Donald Trump is just crazy and out of his mind, and he's a fool, he's arrogant, he's ignorant. Shouldn't even be an option. But Hillary Clinton has demonstrated far more destruction in her role as Secretary of State, in her role as First Lady with her husband Bill, in her role as the Senator of New York State. So you have a proven protector of racism and racist policies that are killing our people. And then you have one who did call the Central Park innocent young men, said that they should be, you know, given the death penalty, who has exploited workers, who has failed businesses, who uttered some of the most sick, racist, vile stuff you ever want to hear, ignorant stuff against immigrants, against black people, against everybody. So, I mean, that's our choice, which is no choice. So far, some concern. It is a teachable moment, and what I'm going to teach, use my time to voting on a national level. I'm voting for writing in reparations now, and it'll be a teachable moment for me. Others say, we got to stop Trump, we got to stop Trump, oh, here comes Trump. Well, look what Hillary already did. So sometimes you got to vote your conscience and vote your principles and either vote for a third-party candidate, one of the third-party candidates, or write in someone, or vote in a message like I'm voting in reparations now. We need to take a stand because there's no win on that level. We got to stay vigilant. The struggle continues, and nor should we be fooled by the 2 conventions. A lot of glitter, a lot of glamour, a lot of euphoric speeches, even if it comes from the president and his wife. They're great orators, great speakers, but they ended it by saying, I support her. And as far as I'm concerned, that takes away from everything that you've said. And they're saying that to the same lady that they vilified and attacked, and she attacked them when he was running for president. And I don't know how 7 years later she becomes that great after 7 years ago you were saying how terrible she was, and Michelle was saying how this is the first time that she felt proud about her country. Now, 7 years later, this is the greatest country in the world. So I think they tied into that democratic machine, and they have to say these things. But don't be fooled by the glitter and glamour of staged conventions. These are the 2 worst candidates in the history. Both of them have low approval rates, low rates of honesty and trustworthiness, 35% for Trump, 34% for Hillary. That's the lowest for 2 candidates in the history of this country.
That's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.